to the New Oral Cultures podcast. Now, I know you're accustomed to hearing the dulcet tones of your usual host, my colleague Dario Linares in the UK, but on this episode, I will be your guest host. My name is John Sullivan, and I'm a professor of media and communication at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is in the USA. I'm very excited today because on the podcast, we're going to be joined by Dr. Andrew Bottomley. Andrew is an assistant professor of media studies at the State University of New York in Oneonta, a fellow American. His research is concerned with the social and cultural dimensions of communication technologies, in particular, the internet and broadcast radio, podcasting, recorded music, and other forms of sound media. He's particularly interested in the history of new and emerging media, especially during moments of technological convergence and transference where old media meets new media. Andrew just recently published his first book entitled Sound Streams, A Cultural History of Radio Internet Convergence, and that's going to be the main subject of our conversation today. The book was published with the University of Michigan Press, and I'll put a link for more information about the book in the show notes for this episode. Andrew's my guest for the next hour, and I'm really looking forward to talking with him about the history of internet radio, which includes, of course, podcasting. Andrew, welcome to the New Oral Cultures podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. First of all, congratulations on the book. It's a huge undertaking. As someone who's undertaking it now, it's really a bear. So congratulations on completing the book itself.
Oh, thank you. It's done now and I don't really know what to do with myself. So
you have so much time on your hands, like all of us who are trying to manage the pandemic. I'm curious, because I've been seeing a lot of things in the news that go one way or the other. Have you increased your podcast listening during the pandemic, or has it stayed the same, or has it gotten less?
Not at all. No, it's gotten less for sure. I've been following that too, obviously, just anecdotally with like friends and everything. And it does seem like, you know, people are splitting down the line there where some people are like, I'm home all the time. I'm listening to all these podcasts. And I mean, I sort of almost feel ashamed to say it because, you know, I'm like the podcast guy. Everyone, I think, assumes that I just listen to podcasts day and night. I do listen to a lot of radio, actually. Like that doesn't really change. And if anything, I probably listen to a bit more broadcast radio because I just sort of turn it on and tap listen to it in the house. I'm like in the morning when I'm getting ready and I actually go to sleep listening to like BBC. Like, and so I've been listening to plenty of stuff, but podcasts are for me, I'm very particular about how and when I listen to podcasts. And actually, I know that all the podcasters I know kind of cringe when you say it, but I listen in the car primarily, which in two ways means that I listened a lot less than I would actually prefer nowadays. One, because in the last few years now, I've been in upstate New York and I actually don't have much of a commute. So when I lived in New York City years ago, or even when I was in grad school in Madison, Wisconsin, I commuted a bit more. So I would listen in those interstitial moments. And so I've kind of already lost that even just in the past couple of years. But with the podcast, I'm not going anywhere. I mean, with the pandemic, I'm not going anywhere. So I've definitely been listening less. You know, I mean, I've picked up a few new things, but mostly I'm, you know, because I still find time to listen at home, but it just feels like everything now takes longer. There's more asked of us in terms of teaching online and everything. So those kind of, you know, those moments when I might fit a half hour or an hour podcast in. So I've kind of just find myself with fewer of those. So I've been mostly trying to just keep up with old favorites. Haven't had a chance to discover too many brand new things. I mean, a handful of shows, but not nearly as much as, you know, people always ask me for podcast recommendations and I'm going to be like, usually like, oh, have you heard Radiolab? You know,
not really. Well, I'm so relieved to hear you say that actually, because I've experienced exactly the same thing. And I have a kind of sense of guilt about that I should be listening to more podcasts because I should have more time than I've ever had before because of the pandemic. But the reality is that I'm constantly interrupted now more than I was before, whether it's kids who are doing e-learning at home, whether it's anything like that. I find that I have less concentrated blocks of time, and I was always looking forward to those as a vehicle to listen to podcasts, because while I can feel interrupted when I'm listening to just music on the radio, that's fine. I really don't like to be interrupted in my podcast listening. It just disrupts the flow that I really enjoy with spoken word podcasts.
Right. I mean, especially when, you know, when it's this thing that, you know, you're studying academically, I mean, you need to do close listening. And so just like you say, that kind of uninterrupted listening time, there's so much less of it now. And I think one of the things that I've probably been most energized about in the last couple years in podcasting has been fiction podcasting, and sort of there being a lot more kind of creative audio happening in terms of kind of radio art stuff that's now starting to happen in the podcasting realm. And that stuff is it's not the kind of thing you just sort of turn on when you're doing the dishes. Certainly not if you have any plans to maybe be writing about it or whatever. Those moments, it's pretty rare that I'm just going to sit on the couch with a pair of headphones without a half dozen interruptions in the span of a half hour. So I have found it pretty hard to listen to a lot of podcasts at this time. And, I guess I always have kind of FOMO about it anyway. Again, I mean, everyone always expects that that's all I ever do. But I study television and film and I teach those things too. So, it's pretty hard to keep up with everything all the time. And so, this has definitely brought out my FOMO more than I already had.
Right. Well, let's jump into the book because there's so much great stuff to talk about with the book. But I want to start out with your overall approach to studying internet radio, internet audio. So you kind of make what I would maybe claim as a bold and potentially controversial claim early in the book, but maybe not so bold or controversial. And that's that, let's say, the podcasting or the internet audio we have today is not necessarily as new or different as people think. In essence, and correct me if I'm misstating here, you see podcasting and other forms of online audio is essentially an outgrowth of the medium that we've had for a century now, radio. Can you say a little bit about that, and did I characterize that correctly, and why do you think that is?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, you did characterize it correctly. One of the overarching aims of the book really is indeed to create a history of, the convergence of radio and the internet, and then, of course, what has happened with internet audio since, including podcasting and streaming music. But I pitch a really broad scope there. I'm looking at a little bit at everything. And a big part of that is that I'm looking to connect the present with the past, and really the present with the distant past, often going back really to the origins of radio and the early part of the 20th century. And so I think, one of the main things that I'm doing there is trying to make that argument about convergence and remediation and these other ideas that I think most listeners should be familiar with it. But just the idea that the new is always building on the old, right? That we don't have these, and a lot of that is kind of trying to challenge a lot of the discourse that particularly surrounds podcasting because of how closely podcasting is sort of attached to the tech world, and sort of computer technology and kind of internet technology and kind of your sort of Silicon Valley kind of tech. There's obviously this discourse of disruption and of kind of revolution. So much of what's happened in podcasting, because it comes out of that computer technology realm, is that it's been sort of separated from radio. And I think I'm not alone in this, that there's been this sort of, kind of like slow kind of like reunification of radio and podcasting. I think more and more people are becoming accepting of that idea that podcasting is somehow connected to radio. But it felt like, when I started this book, 7 years ago or whatever, when I really, and certainly in the years before that, there was a real separation. A lot of people felt podcasting was this like whole other thing that was completely disconnected from radio. Although, strangely enough, if you talked to a lot of the people who were doing podcasting, and I mean people who really didn't have much connection to radio at all, they still would talk about it as if it was radio, but they weren't radio people. So podcasting was sort of different. And that gets to one of the, one of the main points there is a lot of it is how you frame it, right? So from which, you think about the different ways that you can look at any form of media or any form of culture. And, if you're a political economist, it's, you're taking an economic angle, right? If you're a technologist, you're going to look at the technology. Full disclosure, right? I'm a media and cultural studies scholar. So I'm very much coming at it from a cultural angle that's going to primarily look at it, from a what are the people doing with it kind of tack. But also one that's...
And I noticed that in the book, not to interrupt, but I noticed that in the book that you kind of even define radio less as, it's not a technological definition, it's a kind of sociocultural definition of radio, right?
Absolutely, right. And I talk about one of the kind of the core the main sort of thread through all different types of radio, and that I see connecting to the present, is this idea of sociability. So it's really about what does the medium do, and the way that it kind of brings people together, and the way that people use it to address others and address the public and so on. And maybe we can come back to that point a little bit more. But, you know, I talk about the idea, and I'm not the only one who's ever sort of made this claim, but to think about what is the measure of the medium. And so, I mean, you think about, you know, so, you know, again, how are you measuring the medium? How are you defining it? You know, through what lens are you looking at it? And so, again, if you look at purely technology, it's very easy to say podcasting is something other than radio. To me, that approach breaks, and same thing with streaming audio and everything else, right? It has a very different technological basis. And then also, when you even look at industry, at least initially, a lot of the people who were doing streaming, like streaming music, or doing early versions of online radio, internet radio in the early 1990s, people who were doing early podcasting, they weren't radio people for the most part. They were either just sort of amateurs who were just kind of coming to it for one reason or another. They might have been like college radio people. That's like one thing that was, you know, at least with the initial kind of simulcast sort of streaming was college radio. But they were people who were like maybe on the fringes of what we would call the radio industry. You know, so again, the people are coming from different perspectives. But ultimately, when you think about what their aims were, what they were trying to achieve, how they were approaching the medium, what they were trying to do with the medium with the format of audio, it comes back to a radio place in my mind. And the same is true, you know, if you look at radio across its long history. And so that gets, just to come back to the original point, I mean, if you look at radio from its initial origins as a kind of point-to-point medium, and, you know, and then with its early kind of amateur, kind of what we would think of as like the ham radio kind of culture in the 1920s, the 19-teens and 1920s, then it's early, then becoming sort of the networks and the kind of the institutionalized form of radio that we understand it. But then even through, you know, you have the sort of the golden age of radio from the, you know, late 20s to the about the early 60s with the big networks. I mean, you still had, you know, alternative broadcasters, educational broadcasters in particular. And then once TV kind of takes radio's shine and a lot of the big, you know, networks and corporations abandon radio for the most part, we have it break up, and then it becomes, you know, think about the 70s, you have like the freeform radio movement and then the college radio and community radio, public radio today. There's so many different forms of radio. They certainly don't operate under one single logic. And then even if you also think about things like CB radio, which probably harkens the most back to like the early kind of ham radio culture, you know, and maybe that's where like podcasts is in some ways, at least early podcasting that we sort of attribute to mostly amateurs is maybe the most like that sort of teens, early 20s kind of, you know, kids in their garages kind of building crystal sets and, you know, just sort of the idea of DXing, just sort of sending messages out into the ether, is like, is anyone there kind of thing. There's that kind of spirit you see reborn in the early internet radio and the early podcasting in the 1990s, early 2000s. But again, you know, there's so many different types of radio, different formats of radio, different sort of institutions of radio. So there's no one kind of way to define radio. And I think the same is true now of streaming audio and, you know, internet radio and podcasting. That, again, I think any definition that tries to look at it as technology through a technological lens alone or through an economic lens alone is always missing something. And so to me, that sort of sociocultural approach is the one that really can capture most or all forms of radio, and then also one that then can most easily link radio podcasting to the radio of the past and look at a lineage. And of course, there are differences. I mean, there are differences. Although even many of those differences, if you start to go through them, like thinking about even, you know, think about the things that people always kind of claim that podcasting can do that radio can't, and it's things like length and, you know, not having to follow a clock, for instance. But of course, not all radio follows a clock in that tight way that like NPR kind of public radio does, that, you know, where they always have to fill a news hole and so on. Like, I mean, if you listen to a lot of free form or kind of college radio, I mean, they may have a loose schedule of like a show every 2 hours or something, but within that.
Right. Or pirate radio for that matter, right? Go back to the history of pirate radio.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's this there's a great kind of revival of pirate radio happening right now. I mean, has always been, but it's been, I think it's gotten at least a bit more attention. And, you know, in places like New York City, some really wonderful kind of diasporic and ethnic pirate radio happening that's sort of targeting, you know, these sort of really niche communities. And, you know, I think that's what a lot of people think, you know, podcasting does, is that it's a narrow cast kind of medium. Radio is that too, at least certain types of radio. So It's more that, you know, I sometimes kind of want to back off trying to be, you know, too prescriptive with any kind of definitions. And it becomes kind of easy to start to make a checklist of like, well, radio does this and podcasting does this. And so, you know, it becomes that sort of like...
Going back to your earlier point, I think a lot of the... One of the reasons, I imagine there's a lot of reasons why podcasters, indie podcasters, and those who are involved in the podcasting medium want to make a clear distinction between themselves and radio. But when people talk about radio, I have noticed within the podcasting community, it's more big radio, right? They think of, you know, it's commercial radio, it's big network radio, it's like, you know, the CBS's, Westwood, it's all these big players, and even NPR. That the notion of radio is really bracketed off within a particular type of radio that has a particular type of format, a particular kind of structure and time limits, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I really like in the book how you talk about that radio is much more than that. It has been and continues to be much more than that notion of radio. So I think that, at least to my mind, that's what podcasters are reacting against. And the fact that, you know, existing radio networks operate as de facto gatekeepers. And I hear time and time again from podcasters that one of the great things about podcasting is that it is a medium that is devoid of gatekeepers. Now, we can talk about how that's becoming a lot less true than it was, let's say, 10 years ago. But I think there's that same kind of pushback against radio as big radio.
Absolutely. Right. And yeah, I mean, as you say, with there's definitely and I mean, you're the one to say this, right? The platformization of podcasting, I think, is, and that's one of my big concerns. I think there's a lot of opportunities there in what's happening in the way that podcasting is becoming more professionalized. I mean, it's certainly great for a certain fraction of radio podcast producers. They're able to be quite successful now. And I think that's great that, you know, that there's a lot of employment happening and so on. But it is also really narrowing the kind of boundaries, at least on terms of a reach, you know, podcasts that get to a certain scale. And it's sort of tightening, you know, what we often think of as a form of kind of user generated kind of grassroots content is definitely not that. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, you said a lot there that I agree with all of it, and I think you raise a great number of points. One thing I'll kind of jump in on though is, you know, what I love about radio, and it's just one. I mean, it's one of the things that just makes me, you know, love the medium of radio and kind of audio more general. Again, I define radio as including podcasting and all these things. So I mean, when I say that, I mean podcasting and all of it, is just how inclusive it is. And it historically has been, you know, radio out of all of our kind of mass media. So, I mean, I guess print, you know, it can be more accessible, but it often is more expensive actually. Whereas radio kind of is welcomes all comers in a way that certainly television cannot, just simply cannot, because of scale issues and even internet, you know. And this is where you know, one of these things where, you know, podcasting is maybe not quite as accessible as everyone claims it is, particularly if you go back to the early years of it. It was not quite as easy as just, you know, go online and you have a podcast. This was, you know, if you think about the early 2000s, mid 2000s even, like getting audio into a computer actually wasn't that simple. Most people didn't know how to do it. It required a certain technology that was still pretty expensive, hosting it and all these issues. But I'm kind of already going on a tangent.
And then finding it. So discovery was another huge problem, right?
Yeah. But radio, even, you know, throughout all that, you know, again, partly because of the fact that there's so many different kind of platforms or different forms of radio, again, from your, you know, think about, you know, most colleges have radio stations. A lot of, you know, most towns of any kind of, you know, decent size, and I don't even mean near a city, have, you know, some form of a community station, you know, somewhere, some sort of public radio or community radio station. And then, of course, you know, there are those, the big guys that everyone sort of, you know, seems to frame radio as, iHeart, you know, for instance, or NPR has oddly become kind of the big bad wolf in a way. Certainly, if you're looking at the sort of the documentary kind of narrative nonfiction audio, where most of the people who are doing that kind of documentary style podcasting in that kind of This American Life vein have come from NPR. So they've sort of, their frustrations with NPR, you know, have sort of, you know, tainted the way that they, as they carry over into the podcasting world. It's funny how NPR has had to, in both, we'd have none of that podcasting without NPR, but NPR also becomes kind of the thing that everyone defines themselves against, right? And that's a big part. That's a big part of what the book's actually about. Is I'm looking at cultural discourse and the way in which, you know, these particularly producers, people who are inventing the technology and also making the early programming in internet radio in the 90s and in podcasting in the early 2000s and, you know, even up to the present day, the way in which they're sort of defining themselves and their identities as producers and like what their shows, what their programming is and who their programming is for. It is really interesting, the point that I was trying to make all the a few minutes back, is how radio becomes this kind of signifier that people are often will often distance themselves from. You know, so people here, I mean, people working and making radio in kind of internet spaces online. And then at the same time, fully embrace it when it's up, when it works in their favor, right? Radio, you know, throughout, you know, I won't even really kind of list them off because there's so many, you know, ways in this which this happens kind of constantly. I mean, but you even just look at the names of so many kind of podcast groups, networks and things like Radiotopia, right? How many shows have radio in the title? We're never on the radio, they're podcasts, right? So radio becomes an easy way of kind of signaling like the type of program it is. So when you think about things like genre, you know, certainly radio still holds very a lot of meaning, even to those people who don't really want to be associated with the radio. Radio still, in terms of a certain type of storytelling, a certain types of presentational style, means something. It, you know, there's legal ways too. You know, I have a chapter that primarily looks at that is about music streaming and Pandora. Pandora has been very opportunistic in the way in which they'll sort of lay claim that they define themselves against radio quite often. And then when it comes to things like licensing, where they can get a big advantage by being a radio service, and they have to, you know, pay less in the way of royalties and things, you know, then they'll claim radio, right? And so and you see it in a lot of, particularly when these services are new, they use radio as a way of making themselves legible to the public, because people don't really know like what is internet audio, and it's easy to say like, oh, it's like it's radio on the internet or whatever. And then at the same time they're like, no, but we also are, you know, not radio. It like almost in the same breath. It's like we are radio, but not. And of course, that you see that all the time with any kind of new media, that it's always defining itself as kind of old plus something, right? Every new version of the telephone or whatever, it's going to be, you know, is you know, you think of like you think of the car phone and then the mobile phone and then the smartphone. It's like the car phone, it's like it's a landline phone, but it's in your car. And then like, right, mobile phone, it's like a car phone, but you can take it everywhere with you, right? Right. You know, and then like, right, the smartphone is like, it's like a mobile phone, but it also is like a computer, right? It's always like it's old plus, right? And that's how actually most technologists think, right? They don't start out thinking about things as being completely new. They understand, people who actually are the tinkerers who are inventing technologies, they understand that most everything's been done before. What is new is going to be the combination of things or finding a new way to sort of solve a problem using the existing technologies. So you're kind of hacking things together. And I think, you know, I talk about kind of the hacker ethic, and most of the people that I'm looking at in the early years of particularly internet radio, but also podcasting, I think would kind of gladly define themselves as hackers, if they weren't literally hacking things. And some of them were, like with college radio, they were literally hacking like video sort of meeting software with, you know, with these other audio programs and sort of and internet servers to make the first simulcast streams. They were literally just hacking things together. Other people, like Carl Malamud and Internet Multicasting Service, and Dave Weiner when he was working on podcasting, I mean, they were actually building new technologies, but they understood them in relationship to things like broadcasting. Like Dave Weiner, as much as he like has very firm definitions of podcasting, and I'll say I've never actually spoken to him. We have had some Twitter exchanges and things, but yeah, I know he can be a little bit of a, he actually sort of said that, like, I don't want to talk about it. He just writes about it, right? He's a prolific blogger. Yeah, and so yeah, he's sort of saying, these are my statements, this is what I believe, just sort of go to the record or whatever. And I mean, I've gone to the record, right? And he very much, like, you know, he uses broadcasting as a metaphor throughout the early podcasting, and it, you know, when he was developing those technologies. And so he really was understanding it in a way as a form of basically trying to recapture broadcasting in an internet environment, particularly again in like a dial-up culture where trying to live stream things was often a really frustrating experience, where, you know, you'd have all the buffering or whatever. So the idea of podcasting was actually trying to recapture the idea of broadcasting, of where you get a kind of continuous flow. So the idea is that you download it like overnight or whatever, and then when you open up your computer in the morning, you just have some programs sitting there and you could just press play and you'd get a seamless experience like listening to radio. Because you couldn't get that with most live casting, live streaming of the era. If you were just listening to, you know, going and logging onto a radio station on a website or whatever, if they even had a true simulcast feed, it would often be so choppy and so on. So, you know, again, that's one of the things I'm really looking at, is to think about how podcasting as we have it today and as we understand it today, I mean, like, one, just the simple point that it exists because of radio. Like, there is no podcasting without radio. But more so, what can we learn from radio's past to inform podcasting's present? And a lot of that is, again, I think, you know, it comes in terms of content. And, you know, I love the way that podcasting is starting to revive forms of radio that have been essentially long dead, at least in the United States. Like, we haven't had very much radio drama production, you know, or radio art has been extremely niche and, you know, only on sort of small community stations and things for the most part in the United States for the last 20, 30, even 40 years. You know, it's a different story in the UK and Europe, and, you know, they have different traditions. But,
I will jump in there. And yeah, one of my favorite audio, as I've been listening to audio dramas for quite a while, but for me, it was a vehicle to try and continue on with my hardcore Doctor Who fandom, which was yanked off the air in 1989 and then lived on in this kind of afterlife in the form of audio dramas produced by a company called Big Finish, which does an excellent job with audio dramas. So I've been like ordering CDs and listening to audio dramas just because I'm trying to access Doctor Who content. This was long before the show was revitalized in 2005, but they're still doing that. And they're bringing back some of the original actors to record new audio episodes. So for me, it was almost like that audio drama never left, but I'm a very obviously niche audience for that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I mean, those people who I think are really sort of fans of audio drama, you know, knew where to get it. Although it would still be a pretty rare experience. You know, again, that's one of those things where the convergence culture of the internet and audio has been in our lives for quite a while, because, you know, I think also of old time radio, you know, particularly the community, the sort of fan collector community that's primarily through Internet Archive nowadays. And it's been around for quite a long time and it's really robust. You know, it's such a great vehicle for, and the way that the internet has enabled this community that of course existed. They used to trade tapes and you could mail away for CDs, like you're saying, but it's made it so much more accessible, particularly for people who are new, right? People who might not have been into that stuff before. And also now that there's all these people, young producers, I mean, people in their, you know, early 20s and so on, who are starting to get the kind of bug for sort of doing like sci-fi or horror kind of radio drama, now can just with a click of the computer go and find all these old suspense programs or Art Doblin or whatever, right? You know, and all this just amazing stuff that is just, it's there because of the internet, right? So that's a great kind of way, and that's a great convergence of internet and radio that we have to thank for, again, I think a way of making kind of old radio a tool for new radio, in quotes, podcasting, whatever form it might take, to thrive, right? And to learn from what was done in the past, right? That there isn't an amnesia. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, in so much documentary production, so much, again, of the kind of radio drama stuff, I think if you only grew up listening to what has been on NPR or whatever for the last 20, 30 years, you'd think, oh, it's sort of so staid. And, you know, with a few exceptions like Radiolab or This American Life or whatever, you know, radio documentaries, I mean, it's sort of the audio version of a Ken Burns PBS documentary or whatever. It's very much just these sort of talking heads. And there's, you know, it's the same bag of tricks, kind of. It's pretty fuddy-duddy. I mean, I love it, but, you know, I mean, like all things considered, there's not really a bleeding edge there. There's not a lot of, like, you know, true experimentation happening.
Right. And that's a part of the, I assume that's by design, right? Yeah. They don't want to necessarily push the boundaries in that kind of programming, because that would lead to kind of a revolt of a good number of their listeners, I'm sure.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, if you listen to people like Bill Siemering, who's, you know, obviously one of the wrote the mission statement for NPR and was the early founders and programming director. And, you know, there was definitely more of an experimental bent in the early years of NPR, like in the 70s. And as it became more institutionalized, more dependent upon donors. It became much more conservative. And I mean conservative here in just a less experimental kind of culture. I mean, it probably is conservative in other ways too, but I mean, like, they were willing to try to be really kind of, challenging in their programming for the fear of losing listeners. They became as concerned about metrics as the commercial networks, really, frankly. And so, you know, again, if you're someone who's grown up, if you're 25 years old today and you're interested in being an audio producer and you've only mostly listened to radio growing up, you'd think that it's sort of this is all it is. It's really a pretty limited range of stuff. And particularly if you weren't really maybe someone who got into, weren't lucky enough to have kind of more of a fringe pirate or community station around that might have offered some real alternatives. But now you can go online. I mean, you listen back to, the programs of like Norman Corwin or, of course, Orson Welles is like, radio work and many others who are even more kind of, experimental than that. And, there's just this all this stuff that you can listen to and be like, wow, like they were doing that 70, 80 years ago in some cases. And there's so much that you can learn there about how to use audio and to form a kind of a sense of time and place and so on. Right? I think you have like Neil Verma's great book on, Theater of the Mind on Golden Age radio drama. And, again, it's just like it's all there. It's all been done before. And I don't say that I don't mean to sound cynical about that. I do get a little flustered when people in the podcasting world really try to distance themselves from radio and try to be like, oh, well, radio is X and podcasting is doing that. I was like, well, radio now, if you're listening to those few stations, is X, but it's also Y and Z and A and B and C and D. And certainly in the past, it's been E and F and G and H. And, so it's just like, and I say that not to be argumentative, but to say, why don't we go back to that and learn from it, and why don't we use this great history of radio to continue to build this sort of great, world of audio and to make things that are more immersive, more sort of like intellectually and creatively challenging and so on. And
I mean, do you think, Andrew, that when people are being a little bit dismissive about radio, what they may also be kind of reacting to, and that's one of the points that I wanted to follow up with you on the book, is the reemergence of some of these genres like radio drama and others, and these like documentary style journalism that kind of, and citizen journalism that even show up in podcasting, and that people are kind of drifting away from radio. That the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which then led to Clear Channel buying up 1,200 plus stations within the next 5 years and almost completely homogenizing the medium into very limited playlists, etc., kind of destroyed, in a way, they certainly didn't destroy college radio, which has always been there and continued to be innovative. But in terms of the radio that people generally listen to, commercial radio stations, they just became so homogenized that people began to, and over-commercialized, right? The number of commercial minutes per hour started expanding dramatically. And people just turned away from that. They said, this is not something I want to listen to. I want something that's interesting, that's less commercialized, etc. To what extent do you think that at least fueled some of the early interest in podcasting? Or do you think there wasn't a connection there?
I mean, that's an excellent point. I mean, that's an excellent point and an excellent question. It definitely had, it played a huge role, I think, in closing off radio to a certain generation of people as seeing it as something that they would want to go into and something that would be accepting of them. Now, of course, the tricky thing there is two things, right? One, at that point, we're thinking about the mid-late 90s. If you were someone who's doing kind of audio documentary type of work, there wasn't a commercial version of that, or radio drama. There was not a commercial outlet for that in the United States. It's different in Canada with the CBC. It's different in Australia. It's different in England and other places in Europe. But even still, it's a pretty marginal, there's maybe a few outlets, but in the United States, really, there's almost nothing. NPR is maybe and public radio stations that might have at least in terms of if you want to do this for a living and not just a hobby, and most if you're going to do it on community radio or whatever, it's most likely going to be like you just want to make some art and that's going to be your reward. Is right making some art. There's not too many places that are going to commission those kinds of stuff, at least at that time. So you know, realize that what's available to you is already pretty limited. And I can, so I definitely understand that sort of frustration that people then are then going to be in the late 90s and early 2000s were maybe looking for another space. Now, of course, in early podcasting, there wasn't really that much of that kind of full-blown documentary work. You primarily have like talk radio kind of stuff. And I think so, what I think there is a closer connection there to, you know, people who kind of the kinds of talk-based radio or talk-based audio, if we want to use that term, that you had in early podcasting. I mean, certainly sounds to me, if we're going to just go purely on kind of aesthetic and content value, like anything that could have been on college radio or could have been on a community station that maybe people just didn't know, maybe they didn't have it in their community, or more just felt like, you know, like that's radio, that's this whole other thing. I've got to get trained or whatever. I mean, it's not a lot of training, but God knows, I know from being a, you know, a college radio faculty advisor that the 8 or 9 hours of training that's required to get on the air is too much of a hurdle for many students who would otherwise seem interested. And I know, I mean, I had friends around that time in the 90s who like got shows, and even I at that time was like, you know, they went through the training for the local community station, and I was kind of like, yeah, I'll guest on your show, like, you know, I'll show up every now and again, but like, I didn't want to do it, you know. So I can see that there's certain gatekeeping. I mean, there are, it's a pretty small gate that any 4-year-old could leap. But, you know, for a lot of us, any form of gate is just enough to keep us out. And so there is something about that enthusiasm of the internet, particularly in that era of the late 90s and early 2000s. I mean, we're talking about a really utopian era of the web and feeling like it's sort of anything's possible. So I think a lot of people felt like even if it existed in radio, it wasn't like radio wasn't really something that they felt was open to them. Or it just felt like, well, the internet, like that's the new thing. And I'll come back to that point again, because I think the shine of the new and the tinge of the old is something that plays a big role here. A lot of people, again, I mean, I could say that radio is all of these things, and a lot of people are going to be like, yeah, but radio, like it's so much is packed into a word, right? And so a lot, yes, of people think radio and is old.
Yeah, there's a
radio
lot of freighted meanings. Yeah,
certainly when we talk about Clear Channel and, you know, what's now iHeart and that homogenization of radio and radio plays, of course we're talking about music radio primarily. And we're talking about some talk radio too, of course, syndicated talk radio. And that's the, to me, one of the really sad tales of internet radio is music radio. And for the most part, you know, particularly in terms of podcasting, I mean, there really is no such thing as music podcasting. I mean, there's begun to be, in the last handful of years, podcasts about music and music culture, like Song Exploder, you know, for instance. And there's actually quite a good many of them now. They've started to figure it out. But you can't have a podcast that's just a stream of music, like a playlist. At least not one, you know, there's some different apps and things that claim to let you do it. I still don't fully understand how they legally get away with it. But you know, for the most part, because of all the licensing things around music, and this actually has some to do with radio and conglomeration, but as much or more to do with the RIAA and the music industry just being spiteful and trying to milk every last cent and really blocking, in many ways, blocking music radio online. And so what you have is, you have in the 90s, when people were trying to figure all this out and it was kind of more of a Wild West kind of thing, you had a good many sort of startups that were trying to do music radio on the internet and really feeding into, you know, filling the void that was being left by commercial radio of, you know, of it, like underground music and sort of alternative genres and also just older musics, right? You know, like, you know, 1940s music or whatever, which eventually with like Sirius and XM, we do start to get that market served a little bit, but I don't really know if I want to go there. With satellite is a whole other thing. But the point there is that, you know, people were able to, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, this is really exciting. I can have, you know, even college stations and sort of smaller radio stations, like, oh, we can have multiple streams. Like we could have a hip hop stream and we could have a metal stream and all this kind of stuff. And then in the early 2000s, I mean, the license, I don't want to get into all the licensing and royalty, but it was such a gray area and there was so many back and forths where it was allowed, it wasn't allowed, or then, you know, they'd pass these like sort of royalty rates that would only be in effect for like a couple of years. The future was so uncertain. A lot of people just completely either got priced out of it in different ways, because it was really kind of economically unsustainable. If you were an online only music radio station, basically, as soon as you get popular, it becomes completely unaffordable because you have to basically pay royalties per listener. Your server costs and your royalty costs just get insane really quick if you have any. So, you know, it's one thing if you're just doing...
And I have heard from podcasters and just from listening to podcast hosters talk about this as well, is that if you have some kind of copyrighted music content, even as incidental music or background music on your podcast, and you upload it to Apple or to Google's service or to Spotify, there are sophisticated algorithms that will identify that, and you'll immediately be taken down. And it's a good likelihood that you will also, that your entire podcast will also be yanked from those services as well for a copyright violation. So the consequences are both immediate and fairly severe for people to include, even accidentally, some copyrighted music content in their podcast. So much so that podcast hosters just, they hold seminars where they tell people just, you know, don't ever do it. You don't include any recorded music, and which is a huge loss because, of course, music is part of the fabric of our culture today. It's part of what we talk about. It's how we
identify.
And this has been it's a much longer story, obviously. You know, YouTube and online video has been dealing with this for a much longer period of time, but it's a shame, because that's a whole area of our culture that is essentially closed off to the medium of podcasting, at least right now.
Yeah, no, it's squashed so much kind of creative expression. I hadn't heard too much about that, what you're saying there with, you know, Apple and Spotify and these podcast platforms, you know, kind of using algorithms to scan the music. I'm not surprised, because obviously YouTube's been doing that for well over a decade, and they'll pull. So I'm not, you know, the technology obviously exists, and it makes a lot of sense that they would, well, it's sad, but it makes a lot of sense that they would be using it. I know a lot of pretty big podcasters who are really loosey-goosey with using pre-recorded music, and I haven't talked to them about this topic, I guess, in a couple of years now, but I, you know, talk about clearances, and they're like, well, I don't clear anything, and I was like, but you're on a major podcast network?
Well, I think also a lot of these, well, like a lot of the NPR podcasts, for example, a lot of the content appears first on radio, and then it may be distributed later as a podcast. And it's my understanding is completely fine and legal. It's when things are podcast only.
Right. That's the best
that
issue.
You run into problems.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that is the thing where there's just a really unlevel playing field. I'll just end on that. And I was talking about like royalties and everything. If you're a broadcaster and you're either simulcasting things online or even kind of posting content after the fact, you're covered under these sort of blanket licenses that you pay. So you're kind of grandfathered in. If you are satellite radio, basically got a kind of middle, somewhat sweetheart deal, they get to negotiate with like the PROs directly. And then NPR and stuff too, even if they are doing podcast-only programs that don't broadcast, they have the power. And it's as do a few bigger radio stations that are known for doing kind of music podcasts like KEXP. They're big and they're well known, and they can just negotiate directly with the artists. So, you know, and so if they have an artist do like an in-studio session, like they just get they get permission directly from them to use the music, you know, probably royalty free, I imagine, as a kind of PR thing, which, you know, of course is how radio always sort of was understood, that they got to play music essentially for free because it was promotion, you know. But they have a distinct advantage there because they're well established, you know, NPR, KXP, whatever. And then, but if you're someone who's starting up on the internet and you're only an internet streamer or a podcaster, you are completely left out of those loops. And you, it's different in different ways, but the long story short of it is podcasts that use a lot of music and music's and podcasts that might want to do kind of playlists or DJ sets of music, it just is just not a, is not supported, is not encouraged, is not supported. And it's just sort of very sad to me that, you know, I mean, I love music radio, and music radio kind of is radio to a good portion of people. That's the main thing they go to radio for, is music. And it's not been allowed to succeed in podcasts, in the podcast space, or even in the web streaming space, for, you know, 15, 20 years now. It's large, and so it's a huge gaping hole in the world of kind of radio online.
That's fascinating. Well, one of the things I really like about the book, I mean, there are many things that I like about the book, but I think what's needed in the podcasting space right now is to have a very nuanced, I won't say definitive because nothing is ever definitive, but a very nuanced history of podcasting. Because there's a lot of received history about the origins of podcasting. And a lot of it, as you talk about in the book, it's got some of the main key points, maybe correct, but there's a lot that's left out of those histories. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was fascinating. Dave Weiner and Adam Curry, the former MTV VJ, are often associated with the birth of the medium, and you kind of have this moment in there which you relate, which something that I didn't realize was that he was caught at one point kind of editing the Wikipedia entry to play up his
Adam Curry,
his influence in the early part of podcasting's history. So, which brings up a kind of such a broad point for historians in general, and that's that some of the historical sources are self-interested and try, and you know, that history, if it's written by those who are involved in it, oftentimes it will be, you know, not necessarily factually accurate in many different kinds of ways. So what I really appreciate about the book, and I want to point out to everyone who's listening to the podcast, if you're looking for a very good overview of the early history of podcasting as a medium, I would direct you to your book, because it really kind of explores the connections to blogging, which were, I think, have been obscured by the more recent discussions about podcasting. And I've looked at a lot of sort of professional books, people who are podcasters, and there's always an obligatory first chapter or half of a chapter in a lot of these books that talk about, well, where does podcasting come from? And that's where a lot of this received history about podcasting is there, which airbrushes out a lot of the connections to previous media. So I think that's a fascinating aspect of the book. And Adam Curry is coming back around again. He's got this new venture, which I'm not sure if you've heard about, called Podcasting 2.0, where he's coming to rescue the medium from the clutches of platforms like Spotify, yeah, and so on and so forth. And he doesn't want podcasting to be under the control of a single proprietary service or platform service, which I'm sympathetic to that goal. But were you surprised when you started to uncover some of the history of podcasting that there were these disjunctures between what we've come to know as the history of the medium and maybe what's been obscured?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, that's one of those things where, you know, I suppose I'll just say quickly, when I was, you know, when I started the book, I mean, it was my PhD dissertation from University of Wisconsin-Madison. And when I started it, I think it really began with kind of thinking about, like, well, you know, what is radio on the internet, and kind of trying, it was a little bit more theoretical, and that stuff's kind of in the dissertation. Some of it made it in the book. A lot of it actually got cut, but it started to shift pretty quickly. I mean, and so I was actually looking initially at more sort of simulcast and sort of like internet radio, like streaming radio. And it wasn't that I wasn't interested in podcasting. I guess I just had never really thought about it too much. And in the end, the podcasting, so it really what you're referring to there, and thank you for highlighting that and for the praise. I really am proud of that early history of podcasting. It is ultimately really only one chapter. I mean, there's other bits threaded throughout the book. It is the one chapter that I realized sort of resonates with people the most, and I'm not surprised by that. It became pretty clear once the book had this really large scope and for all the reasons that we've discussing about kind of creating these sense of a long durée, a kind of and all these through lines between radio and of the sort of the recent and also distant past and of our kind of digital present. But I realized, you know, that the podcasting history there, I mean, it could obviously be its own book. And I feel like in a way that chapter that you're referring to there, that Everybody Speaks chapter, is almost just like my draft notes on that history, because I mean, I haven't had anyone scream at me yet, but I have had some folks like Dave Weiner via like Twitter kind of praise it and seems like I got it right, which is like, whew. I wasn't entirely sure. And because of what you're saying about the sort of received history, because there really is nothing there on that early history. There's some primary sources, people like Dave Weiner, who blogged very prolifically, were writing, and in a sense, you can treat that as like, you know, if you were doing archival research on an old radio station, like internal memos of like, you know, working memos of like, this is what we're building and this is what we're trying to achieve with it, right? And so there's other forums and things, other people who are blogging. Actually, what you can access, it's really difficult actually to get a lot of the early audio, but a lot of what is there is people going back and forth talking in podcasts or like audio blogs about podcasting. They were the people who were kind of building the technology, talking about the technology, which is a great kind of thing about actually, which is really where there's a tie to blogging. Just as a quick aside, right? You know, blogs were initially just sort of links of things that were on the web. It was basically like, here's the stuff I'm into right now, and then and so blogs are kind of meta in that way. It's
like a neural net of people's, you know, where people are on the web.
Exactly. And so audio blogging was fairly similar to that early on, which makes a lot of sense if you understand that connection to blogging, which was an extremely direct connection. I mean, the connection there, again, if you look at a figure like Dave Weiner, I do want to certainly avoid the kind of great man history of anything, but particularly here of podcasting. And so that's where I do, like you say, kind of go through and tell the kind of received history of, well, Dave Weiner and Adam Curry kind of created, you know, podcasting. And it's not that they didn't. I mean, they did do a lot. And I think particularly Weiner, I have no real knowledge or never had any communication with Adam Curry, but I definitely feel like he was one of these guys who had sort of a couple of ideas. And then he was important for getting content out there early on and being a public figure who started doing podcasts that people listened to because he was Adam Curry, MTV VJ. So that helped draw attention to the medium. But, you know, yeah, I think he overstates his role at certain points. I don't think Dave Weiner is maybe a little humble about his role. I mean, he also brags about it in his own kind of way. He did a lot, right? There were certain key figures who did a lot to build the technology and to test it out. But there's also just, you know, again, but a lot of that is maybe, and I still question what I'm missing. And again, I that is one piece of the book that I certainly intend to go back to. And I don't have a book proposal for it or anything, but I definitely could see doing a kind of a book on podcasting and particularly its early history. And I basically stop at like when podcasting became what we know as podcasting, like 2004, 2005, podcasting starts to take off. Like I stop, you know, in terms of like that, that real cultural history. I mean, I talk about in later chapters about shows that are podcasts and kind of what they're doing. But, you know, in terms of a lot of the kind of who created what, when, and particularly what I'm focused on is like what was inspiring them to do what they were doing and what were they trying to achieve with it. And that's where the whole connection between audio blogging is really interesting, like blogging and audio blogging, what we now know as podcasting. And then also its ties to social media, and particularly it's kind of the kind of weird little roots that Twitter has in podcasting, which I think is one of those things that, again, some people, it comes up, you know, in the few books now that have been written about Twitter. You know, it'll be mentioned that, oh, that, you know, Twitter was, it was Odeo, this sort of podcasting platform that just sort of failed really quickly and they had to pivot and they became Twitter and they, damn. And then the rest of it is, that's it. You know, it's the rest of it's Twitter. And then.
Right. But it's so much more complicated than that, right?
It is. And what I think is, again, I still wonder how much of it, because there wasn't even a lot of like what we would call kind of reporting on it, you know, like New York Times or like sort of, you know, big magazines or newspapers doing kind of in-depth feature articles on these things. There was maybe a little bit of like, you know, there's some press releases, you know, which of course is, you know, spin, but you can kind of read between the lines of it, or at least look for those kind of mission statement kind of things or what they were trying to do. There was some, you know, sort of tech reporting, but it'd often be like a couple of paragraphs like, oh, Odeo is like shutting its doors and becoming Twitter. And you'd have to like pick out the little pieces. A lot of it is that detective work of trying to go through various, you know, forums and interviews and the little bit of reporting that existed to try to sort of really understand what was what and what happened when. With Odeo and Twitter, I mean, one of the things, I mean, a little bit I look at just how it, like, as much of as I can go through what its roots actually, you know, in an earlier podcasting service called Oddblog that was run by this guy Noah Glass, and then it became Odeo, and then Odeo became Twitter. But it was more about like how when they pivoted to Twitter, like the idea of like what they were, the idea of what they were trying to do and the way, the type of communication, the type of sort of what social media was in and Twitter's version of it, that like, you know, where were those ideas coming from? And I think you can point to the sort of idea of podcasting and this idea of sort of sending short messages out, because those early audio blogs were just like a minute at most, usually like 3 minute long audio messages that really were like answering machine messages. And there is a tie there to phone technology, which is also really incredibly amazing, because you would call into these services, because again, as we mentioned way back at the early this podcast, getting audio into a computer was actually pretty hard. A lot of people didn't know how to do it, or they didn't have like the microphones and everything. So these early services, you would call up on the phone and record your message, and then that service would post your audio message to your blog as an audio blog. You know, you think about what people say about tweets and everything. I mean, in a way, it's kind of like people's answering machine messages or like audio notes on their phone. Not, I don't even want to get into, you know, the whole thing that now Twitter started audio again. It's like my mind blows. Right, right. They introduced it as like a new feature, like, you know, what, 3 months ago or something. And I was like, that literally was where you began. Like yeah, you were that before you were SMS text. Like, and there were a couple prototypes of Twitter as we know it that were like this list, the idea of a listening post, and that they would basically be audio messages, and they ended up going with the text version, of course, and that's how we know it. But again, I think there's a close relationship there, and that gets back to like the idea that I talk about in the book of like sociability, of like what is radio and the way that we communicate, and a lot of the idea of like affect and the idea of the way, you know, you compare kind of radio communication and the way we talk on radio, you know, and the idea of sort of speaking to a public that's both kind of intimate and mass at the same time. And, you know, you think about like Castell's idea of like mass self-communication, you know, that's how we define a lot of kind of social media, internet communication. I'm like, but radio has been kind of doing that all along. And certainly it's a very different than film or television or, you know, print media. Radio has been that kind of effective and very focused on the individual voice and the subjective experience. And that's where I think, you know, again, I think that was something that was in radio. Again, particularly you think about talk radio and that's carried over to audio blogging, that has carried over not just to podcasting, but carried over in a way to social media, you know, as we know it. And again, that link there of, you know, some of its blogging also has a similar style of voice and presentation. And so, you know, it's all... The point, though, there is I think that we benefit from understanding the linkages between all of these things rather than trying to separate them out. And I think that there, you know, if anything, the history of podcasting, though, to bring that back is like, you know, I think it, in an odd way, it probably needs to be an oral history because, you know, there's just the fact of the matter is that there's people who are really important to that early history who are mostly silent for various reasons, either just because they just didn't record themselves. And we get left with the record of the people like Adam Curry or Dave Weiner, who were kind of prolific and very vocal about their roles. Christopher Lydon a little bit too. You know, he's somebody who's still working in kind of radio and podcasting. And so, you know, people ask them, you know, often what they think and what they did. And there's a lot of names there that might be buried in the historical record. But, you know, I think there's a lot of parsing out of kind of who did what. And there's some very important figures like Noah Glass, who's the guy who did Oddblog and then Odeo and the early Twitter, who I've never been able to get connected with because of just the nastiness of basically getting pushed out of Twitter. I think the guy basically is off the grid. And so any kind of records that Oddblog or Odeo have are either gone because, you know, that's the problem with a lot of these companies. They were sort of internet startups and things. They either go out of, they flop after a year or two. You know, what are there's no archive that collects this stuff, right? Individuals might have saved it. They might have destroyed it. It might have been in someone's hard drive in their attic or in their closet that may or may not, you know, start up if you were to plug it into a computer today, if you even had the right peripherals, you know, but also so a lot of the stuff gets lost just because the companies go away and the history goes with it, or they got swallowed into a bigger company and, you know, either just because it's not a priority, like, you know, for instance, Twitter. I mean, I would guess, I would hope that maybe Twitter has, you know, some of it, you know, records related to their origins in audio, but they're not sharing them. I did try contacting Twitter. I never, you know, there's no, but unlike a legacy media institution where either they've donated some of their records, even Apple, you know, donated some of their early history. I forget what it stops around the early 90s, I think, but it's at Stanford, right? You know, but some of these digital media companies are starting to think about donating their records to public archives, but for the most part, no. And so what you're left with is maybe hoping that they have some sort of corporate archivist or just a librarian in-house, and you might get permission. But I haven't had that luck, you know, even with companies where I've had some encounters with like the CEOs or whatever, with like Real Audio, I've had the luck of getting to chat with Rob Glazer and stuff. But I've sort of mentioned like, oh, I'd love to be curious to see. And then all of a sudden the conversation or the emails go really quiet as soon as I ask to look at like, I'm like, I just want to look at your, you know. Even things like, you know, even things like press releases, like you can find some of them in databases, but there's others that you don't. Or, you know, I realize I'm on a little bit of a tangent, but this is one of these things about doing internet history that I'm sure anyone else who's done it like yourself, I mean, it's truly difficult. You know, we have this idea that everything's on the internet and the internet's sort of permanent. And of course, anyone who actually studies the internet knows that that's incredibly false. It's incredibly ephemeral. And the idea of permanent beta means that it's always changing. So what is the, you know, the finished version of X? right? When you're trying to study things, because it's always editable, it's always changeable. But like, you know, I mean, there's certain things though, like with a lot of internet companies, like I got kind of really geeky about like SEC reports, because it's like
some of the few public records that exist about these companies and what they're doing, right?
Yeah. And while they're, of course, like there's sort of a mix of like kind of PR promotional documents, you realize that they're probably having to play it a little safe with lying to the SEC. So there's like when they mention stats and things, they have to probably be pretty close to honest about, you know, how many users they have or whatever, because, you know, they could get in a lot of trouble if they were caught for
absolutely.
So, you know, I mean, but, you know, something like Odeo wasn't even a public company, so they never filed with the SEC, right? So it's just like, you know, it's so difficult really kind of getting into that history. Again, to bring it back to like early podcasting, it's fascinating. There's a definitely the story that's widely known in my mind is at best partial. I'm not saying it's false, but it's only partial. And I have this sort of nagging fear that I'm missing something really important. And so if anyone hears this and anyone happens to read the book and you were part of that world of early podcasting in like sort of 2000 to 2005, and you know, you're not mentioned, feel free to send me an irritated email.
Reach out to Andrew.
Yeah, no, because I we can do our best as scholars and as historians, you know, we follow the paper trail. I guess that I'll conclude on that point too. Like, I didn't ever intend to necessarily do a history of podcasting, or I guess maybe I also thought I knew the history of podcasting based on that. Oh, like, you know, 2004 iTunes, blah, 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 blah. Right. You know, pod and casting, you know, but no, it was the name podcasting was kind of an afterthought. It was really kind of happenstance that it's even called that. A lot of people, you know, they go back to that Guardian article, the Ben Hammersley article, but like even there he mentions like a bunch of different names for what to call this. He's basically like, what do we call this stuff? And he's, I think he, I forget off the top of my head, I think one was like Guerrilla Radio or something. He, like a couple of them had radio in it, and then it was like podcasting, right. Everyone's like, he named podcasting. I was like, no, he just kind of threw it out into the ether, and other people were like, oh yeah, that one, we'll call it that thing. And as much as people bemoan the name podcasting, it actually did really help the medium grow, being associated with the iPod. I know people today don't, particularly professionals, don't like it. But yeah.
And we may be able to lay some of that at the feet of Apple, who obviously, in the desire to push their own product, the iPod, which was, you know, wildly popular, to basically adopt that as the official name of whatever this medium was.
And the medium stuck. The medium rode, you know, the iPod's coattails. I mean, it was, the whole idea was that where it found a niche was that people had these nice shiny new iPods and they needed to fill them with stuff, and they got, you know, they kind of filled it with the music that they had, or maybe they got tired of music all the time and they're like, oh, maybe I could get some like radio programs. Well, not really, there weren't too many radio programs. And then it was like, oh, there's like these other kind of radio-ishy things, and you know, there you go. So that was a lot of people who weren't already in the community, and that's actually a big part of that story, is that, like, you know, podcasting was kind of around from about 2000, 2001 to like 2004, 2005 when it became mainstreamed, but it wasn't really good. It didn't evolve that much in a few years because it wasn't being taken up. It was just the people who were kind of making it, playing around with it and sharing it with themselves in their kind of small community. And, you know, there's, you know, these ideas of kind of the life cycle of a technology. And I cite like Brian Winston and the idea that, like, you know, there's lots of things that are prototypes and yeah, it's a technology, but it's not it's a thing, it's a device or whatever. But it doesn't really become a technology until it goes sort of becomes socially mainstreamed. There's a lot of, you know, obviously, you know, I talk even about things like the early, like Audible players and stuff that were invented and they were marketed, but like they were, you know, maybe a few thousand of them that ever sold. So the essentially failed technologies. So there's all of these things like where, you know, it's a lot of it is, some of it's happenstance, some of it is good marketing, you know, whatever. But I think there's something there to be said about this sort of the moment of around 2004. It wasn't just Apple and the iPod. That was a big part of it, but it was also going on the coattails of blogging. And that's why the connection to audio blogging is really important, because blogging was the huge internet phenomenon of those early years of the 2000s. So, but then it was a couple years of blogging. blogging, and then it was like, okay, well, what's next? And then like, oh, audio blogging, right? You know, it never really took off as the form of audio blogging, but that gave it its initial kind of foray as a technology or format or whatever you want to call it. And then, it was the iPod and everything kind of really like boosted it. And just to say again that it is a very kind of cultural history that I'm trying to tell, and one that's as much about failures as it is successes, as much about intention as it is about accident. You know, we hear so many histories, particularly, again, non-academic popular histories of how technology evolves, and it's like Great Man or you know, Two Guys in a Garage kind of thing, and it was this brilliant idea and it just took off, you know, and it changed the world, and it was like, it's never that, first of all, it's never that, you know. And but particularly here, it was like, these were very collaborative, you know, media, you know, podcasting, again, there's not one kind of inventor, there's some key figures that deserve credit that they're given, and even with internet radio and people like, we haven't really talked too much about that, but like, I talked about it elsewhere, and it's obviously a big part of the book, is like Carl Malamud and Internet Multicasting Service. I mean, you can very much look at like one person who in 1993 put the first kind of internet radio station on the web, but he still didn't do that alone, and he was picking up on various pieces of technology and ideas that had been developed within the internet engineering community. He was inspired by radio, particularly public radio, in terms of the content and programming he was making and the kind of audiences he was addressing and so on. So, you know, these things don't happen in a vacuum, and I'm trying to just sort of pull as many of the threads together as I can to show how these things have, you know, evolved, not merely just sort of, you know, emerged from the kind of the gooey muck, fully formed, but rather, you know, that they've gradually emerged from, you know, podcasting. To me, I'll end on this, is just to say that the fascinating thing there is that it's part radio, it's part blogging, and it's also part telephone. Right, like I was saying, and then it's a kind of also a early version, and there's some close, you know, we're talking about the early era of social network sites and, you know, social media, and I think podcasting also plays into that in a way that it didn't eventually develop. I mean, people might group podcasting in with various other personal media and kind of put it alongside social media. But podcasting itself, as we know it today, is primarily a kind of producer driven. It's not as much of a community or kind of a dialectic kind of thing like it was in the early years. I think so. In a way, there's a sort of an idea of audio blogging that was a sort of a version of podcasting that could have been, that in many ways didn't happen, which was this idea of people like social media, like we think about Twitter, of people kind of going back and forth with messages in a conversation that was sort of serialized and always evolving and very communal, very much in a way like a kind of an early kind of amateur radio from the 19 teens and 20s, of just people sort of, you know, it was a two-way sort of system, communication system, and that really didn't happen. In the end, podcasting actually emerged to be incredibly radio-like, and I mean radio-like in the kind of almost the negative radio sense that you were mentioning, of particularly as we're getting more into the platformization of it, of sort of big producers kind of issuing, you know, one-to-many. It's a sort of a time-shifted version of broadcasting, of you have a few people producing programs that go out to a large audience who are, I don't want to say passive, because I never really believe that when, you know, as a media scholar, that audiences are passive, but people who just listen for the most part.
Well, this is great. Congratulations again on the book. This has been a fascinating conversation. There's so many different avenues that we've opened up, I think, to explore even further. We got even into the sort of how internet historians can really recapture things, even in the most recent history. So you would think that the further back you go, the more difficult it is to do histories. And that's just really not the case, right? Even things in the most recent history can be extremely challenging to look at. If for no other reason than we don't have the benefit of hindsight to look back and see how things have developed and changed. I mean, I lived through the 1990s and I was not completely, but mostly oblivious to many of the things that you talked about in the chapter. So we can live through these eras of history and not really grasp what's happening all around us. And that's the real need for media histories, for cultural, socio-cultural histories of technology. There's a real, real powerful need for that. So I thank you for the book. I think it's a terrific book. I encourage everyone who's a listener of this podcast, I think would find something incredibly valuable in the book itself. It's called Soundstreams, A Cultural History of Radio Internet Convergence, published by University of Michigan Press. And there'll be a link to more information about the book in the show notes for today's podcast. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. Thank you for the wonderful questions and for taking the time to talk with me. It's been a real joy.
And stay tuned to your next episode. I'm sure Dario will be back with you. But for now, this is your guest host, John Sullivan, saying thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you.